It's the Indie Week on your North Carolina Reading Service, formerly the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, this issue is dated Wednesday, January the 1st, 2020, and is read today by John Federson. Well, we begin after a two-week pause. There was no issue on Christmas Day, but Jeffrey Bielman, the publisher and editor-in-chief, has put together a New Year's issue, which is also quite different from the one we read a couple of weeks ago. This is called 2040 Vision, and dealing with the story of the next two decades and what they might be like in North Carolina and the Triangle area. And he put this together, Mr. Bielman, and we will hear more from him in an extended piece of his own about journalism, the future of. And so let's get right down to it. The first article, written by Jess Stanford, is a research analyst at Carolina Demography. How will North Carolina's population change by 2040? I'm a demographic analyst at Carolina Demography, an applied demography group located within the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Now that means I spent a lot of time thinking about how North Carolina's population is changing and what that means in terms of housing, education, transportation, and our state's economy. In other words, I'm constantly projecting how population changes will affect our state's future. But before we get into predictions about North Carolina in 2040, it's important to talk about the last few decades when our population shifted rapidly but unevenly. Let's talk about how our state has grown. Every year since 1970, we've grown faster than the nation, and projections indicate we'll add roughly 1 million new residents every decade for the next 20 to 30 years. But this growth has been highly uneven across the state. In fact, just three counties accounted for more than half of North Carolina's growth from 2010 to 2015: Wake, Mecklenburg, and Durham. Meanwhile, nearly half of North Carolina's 100 counties have declined in population since 2010. What accounts for this imbalanced growth? Largely, people moving here from other places. Since 2015, North Carolina has averaged more than 110,000 new residents each year. Most of this growth is from net migration, meaning more people are moving to our state than are moving away. And those new residents tend to be more highly educated and live in more urban areas. Since 2010, two-thirds of Wake's growth has come from net migration, meaning about 42 more people move into Wake County each day than move out. Charlotte and its suburbs have seen similar growth. These urban counties now contain more people born outside of North Carolina than people born within our state. They also attract younger adults from more rural counties, accelerating the population decline in rural counties. These changes aren't happening in a vacuum. People tend to follow jobs, and job growth in North Carolina has been highly concentrated. Between 2010 and 2019, statewide employment increased by more than 700,000 jobs, but they were almost entirely all in just 10 urban counties. The remaining 90% of North Carolina counties accounted for just 30% of job growth in nearly a decade. Migration is likely keeping us young. Counties with the highest net migration rates tended to have a steady influx of young adults as they attract young professionals, new families, college students, and military personnel. Counties with large population declines across North Carolina tended to have much older populations as fewer adults choose to locate there or return after college. Of course, there are exceptions to these patterns. Some of our fastest-growing counties are retirement destinations like Brunswick County, with a high net migration rate of older adults. With high and quick growth comes major headaches. Average work commute times are increasing faster than the state average in these largest metro areas, as most workers travel solo in their cars, and housing prices continue to rise. From 2011 to 2016, median rents across the state increased just $23. But across the triangle, median rents saw increases of $100 or more. Barriers to home ownership for many young adults have meant that very few newly occupied units in North Carolina's urban areas are owned. So what does this mean for our region in 2040? Based on current projections, we'll continue to see uneven growth across the state, with two-thirds of growth taking place in the Raleigh and Charlotte metros alone. Rural counties will continue to experience declines, as well as an overall graying of the population. By 2035, more than a quarter of the population in many rural areas will be 65 or older. We'll also see more jobs in the Triangle and Charlotte regions. Industries that have flourished in the past decade, information technology, biotechnology, and banking, all benefit from being in highly educated, dense urban centers. As these industries develop, we'll see growth in the indirect industries that support these businesses, as well as in the types of businesses that support new workers moving there, such as grocery stores and restaurants. Barring unforeseen changes in the natural environment, public policy, or economy, these are the trends we can expect to continue through 2040. There will be more people working in or near the Triangle, more people commuting into the Triangle, and more people needing houses to live in or near the Triangle. In other words, expect more delays on I-40. Our next article is from Pope McCorkle, who is the director of the Center for Political Leadership, Innovation, and Service at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. What will North Carolina politics look like in 2040? Democrats could be on an unstoppable path toward demographic dominance in North Carolina politics by 2040. According to a report last year from researchers at the Brookings Institute and the Center for American Progress, minority groups will make up 40% of the state's population by 2036. And that team projected that the state's election results will turn solidly Democratic blue well before that date. Of course, many Republicans dismiss such demographic analyses as fake news. But the conduct of Republicans since taking over the General Assembly in 2010 suggests a party that senses a foreboding future. Their leadership has done virtually nothing to develop a durable governing style that could appeal to a broad coalition of voters. It instead has worked to maximize short-term gains and game the political system in its favor. Back in 2012, when he was House Speaker, now U.S. Senator Tom Tillis let slip the pessimistic GOP view of North Carolina's political future. That fall, college students at NC State confronted Tillis about the Republican state constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. After declaring his support for Amendment 1, Tillis added, "It's a generational issue. If it passes, I think it'll be repealed within 20 years." While Amendment 1 passed by 65-35% margin, North Carolina progressives did not have to wait a generation for its repeal. Just 3 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court did the job by affirming that same-sex marriage deserved constitutional protection. The next year, Republicans in Raleigh responded with HB 2, banning any local government actions supporting LGBTQ rights, as well as minimum wage standards and economic discrimination. Obscured in the ensuing national condemnation of HB 2 was the fact that the Charlotte City Council's passage of a strong pro-LGBT ordinance had pushed the Republicans' reactionary button. And Charlotte now reliably delivers the same kind of supermajority margins for Democrats found in other big cities across the nation. So does Raleigh. In fact, all of North Carolina's 9 cities above 100,000 residents, as well as Greenville and Asheville, are Democratic bastions or trending that way. The 2.95 million North Carolinians now living in these Democratic cities outpopulate the just over 2.2 million in the state's rural and small town or non-metropolitan counties. The state's Democratic cities also deliver bigger margins on the whole. in non-metropolitan counties, pockets of black voters, as well as whites in college towns and local government centers, can limit the size of Republican victories. And the population gap is expected to grow over the next few decades as rural and small-town North Carolina counties continue to empty out. So, is Democratic destiny manifest in North Carolina? If true, Democratic dominance is assured in other purple states, and thus, American politics will also be decisively blue by 2040. But such a progressive scenario could well be too good to be true. Geographically speaking, the divide between Democratic cities and Republican rural small town areas in North Carolina and other purple states gives only a partial picture. Indeed, it leaves out the majority of just over 5.2 million in between North Carolinians, those living in metropolitan areas outside the state's big cities. A big red wall still stands out in North Carolina's so-called exurban counties and smaller metropolitan areas beyond the higher taxing confines of big city counties. Democrats may want to write off these sources of Republican strength in outer metropolitan North Carolina as merely a function of the state's soon-to-expire whiteness. But such areas may contain a deep-seated country-politan resistance to any kind of urban or university-based liberalism. In cultural terms, its informal anthems could remain in the county populistic vein of Darius Rucker's Wagon Wheel remake, rather than the rock elegiac Carolina on My Mind of expatriate James Taylor. And such wellsprings of country-politan resistance raise a not-so-outside possibility that should deeply concern Democrats about a post-Trump era. This is the prospect that new, non-white Republican politicians could harness this country-politan instinct into a powerful political persuasion. Although her association with Trump could plague her own political future, former South Carolina governor and U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley might be the harbinger with her Indian immigrant family's version of the American dream. And if Democrats fall into the trap of presenting themselves as the new establishment, they will be inviting such a country-politan repudiation that could spread to all but the most highly educated and progressive voters. European versions of this scenario are already developing in the French Yellow Vest movement against Emmanuel Macron's elitist liberalism and British voters' rejection of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party leadership. Non-white Republican candidates in Nikki Haley mold could significantly split the Democratic hope of a dominant multicultural coalition in a new North Carolina and America along education class lines. Bluntly put, the destiny of a new Democratic progressivism in North Carolina and the nation is not at all manifest. The political future may remain up for grabs in 2040 and beyond. And now let's move to education. Mebane Rash, CEO and Editor-in-Chief of Education NC, an independent civic news organization. What will education look like in North Carolina in 2040? Innovation often starts with a disruptive question. What is the purpose of education now? What will it be in 2040? Who gets to decide? And how do we get from here to there? In Singapore, a country many look to as the best in the world when it comes to education, policymakers believe schools should be designed to encourage students to be the creators of knowledge, instead of the consumers of knowledge. The new learning framework is defining the new normal for education in North Carolina, across the United States, and around the world. The Intergovernmental Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development worked with a lot of smart people to figure out how to help states and countries transform their educational systems so that students have, quote, the knowledge, skills, attitudes, and values that learners need to fulfill their potential and contribute to the well-being of their communities and the planet, close quote. Student agency in learning will matter more and more. The earliest adopter of this learning framework in North Carolina is the North Phillips School of Innovation in the Edgecombe County Public Schools, where 30 students were given the opportunity to redesign what schools should look like. Now scaled to 3 grades, this pilot has become an incubator of hope for many across North Carolina who see that this can happen in any classroom, in any school, in any community, without waiting for permission. Innovations take place in a complex ecosystem of politics and public policy. When we think about prompting this system change in education, 3 resolutions are going to be critical. Good governance, alignment towards attainment from birth to career, and our willingness to work together. Ask yourself, who is in charge when it comes to education? We have the governor, the governor's education cabinet, the legislature, the UNC system with 17 campuses, the community college system with 58 campuses, 36 more independent colleges and universities, the State Board of Education, Superintendent of Public Instruction, school boards and superintendents in 115 school districts, 198 charter schools with 12 more on the way, and 100 boards of county commissioners that fund local education. When it is not clear who is in charge, it is not clear who is accountable. System coherence starts with good governance, but there needs to be alignment toward attainment across the birth to career continuum. North Carolina was one of just 5 states without an attainment goal. But a cross-sector collaboration of leaders in education, business, and government came together, and now, by 2030, 2 million North Carolinians will have a high-quality post-secondary degree or credential. Getting to our attainment goal starts with itty-bitty babies and early childhood development. It continues through ameliorating third-grade FAPE, and then keeping our students in school when they could drop out so that they graduate from high school and either go to college or land in a job where they can earn a living wage and support a family. While there is no federal right to education, courts have interpreted our state constitution to require access for all students to a sound basic education. Recently, an independent consultant found that if we don't meet that requirement, the future of the state hangs in the balance. If we are going to address the challenges we face in providing a sound basic education, as our state constitution requires, or the 21st century education our economy of tomorrow requires, we're going to have to work together better. Jeremy Anderson, president of the Education Commission of the States, says, in states where leaps and bounds are being made, leaders have found ways to work across difference. It's a simple litmus test, he says. Can the people who can move this policy meet for coffee, even if they disagree, and talk through some of these differences? We need future-forward solutions for all of our students, all of our teachers, in all of our schools, all of our colleges and universities, and that means in our 23 counties that voted 70% or more for President Trump, in our urban blue crescent, and in the rest of our very purple counties. This, our students, our state, our future, is on all of us. Answer the questions, North Carolina. Make the resolutions around good governance, alignment toward attainment from birth to career, and working together across all the lines of difference, and you will get to the new normal, where innovation takes hold and students become the architects not just of their own learning, but of the future itself. And here comes an article by our governor, Roy Cooper. Should North Carolina be hopeful about the future? The best part of my job is traveling the state of North Carolina, meeting with people from all walks of life. We're a diverse state with many differences, but we are united in our mutual hope for the future. I'm amazed at the depth of this hope, whether people face happy times or hardship. I remember meeting one woman in a shelter during Hurricane Florence. She told me about the brave first responders who swept her to safety as Florence crashed in on her world. She escaped with virtually no possessions, but she had gratitude and hope for the future, and she firmly told me, I'm going to make it. The future is a term that can spark excitement, anxiety, dread, anticipation. But I view the future for our state as an opportunity, a wide open plain of unlimited potential if we seize it. In my job as governor, nothing speaks to the future more than our focus on education. Our teachers and school support personnel have dedicated their careers to nurturing our youngest and shaping the leaders of tomorrow. That's why I'm dedicated to supporting those educators and treating them like the professionals that they are. In 2020, it's time they get the raise they deserve. Education is key to our success. In 2019, we recruited more than 21,000 jobs to our state in both rural and urban areas, the most in 1 year since before the recession. How? By touting our education system, our workers, and the training we can offer through universities and community colleges. These classrooms are portals to the future, and we have to prioritize them over more unnecessary, sweeping corporate tax cuts that rob from our students. From the world's biggest companies to the small business owners with the biggest ideas, our state is open for business and ripe for more economic growth. No conversation about the future is complete without addressing climate change head-on. On this challenge, one of our greatest, I am forcing North Carolina to do its part. In 2019, we moved forward on the Clean Energy Plan, which calls for a 70% reduction in power sector greenhouse gas emissions below 2005 levels by 2030, with carbon neutrality by 2050. In the absence of leadership from Washington, North Carolina is charging ahead, showing we can protect our air and water while creating clean energy jobs of the future. Together with our push for greater resiliency to protect us from natural disasters, North Carolina is moving forward to grow smarter and stronger. Although Republicans blocked it in 2019, I remain hopeful that we will expand Medicaid in North Carolina in the new year. This is the right thing to do for the 500,000 North Carolinians who will be able to access affordable health care. But it's also the smart thing to do for the rural hospitals struggling on the brink of bankruptcy, the 40,000 jobs it can create, the lower health insurance premium it creates for the private sector, and the communities that will be transformed. Over the last 3 years, we've built a strong foundation for the future. We repealed House Bill 2, restored our reputation, and signed a sweeping anti-discrimination executive order. We implemented paid parental leave for state employees. We banned state dollars from being spent on harmful conversion therapy. We worked together to achieve decreases in the rates of opioid overdose deaths and infant mortality. We invested billions to recover stronger and smarter from devastating storms. The momentum we've built and the progress that lies ahead energize me and leave me with hope and optimism. Since taking office, I've talked about my mission as governor. I want a North Carolina where people are better educated, healthier, and have more money in their pockets, so there will be more opportunities for people to have lives of purpose and abundance. For me, these are the keys to a hopeful future, and I'll keep working every day until it's unlocked for every North Carolinian. All righty, our next segment of the 2040 projections on the Indy Week concerns cities and various aspects of three cities, Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, what they will look like in 2040. And for each of these cities, the editor has provided us several separate columnists to write bits. And I may have to pick and choose from each city so we have room for the other items. If I can get back to some of these that I miss, I will get to them. But we start with Raleigh. What will Raleigh look like? And let's get over to Chapel Hill. What will that look like in 2040? Jessica Anderson was first elected to Chapel Hill Town Council in 2015. In 20 years, I envision a Chapel Hill in which my grown children will enjoy living as much as their parents do. We will continue to welcome people from across the state, nation, and world who not only come for UNC, but also for our excellent elementary and secondary schools and the chance to live in a historic, exciting, and progressive community. The North-South Bus Rapid Transit Project will be part of a larger regional transit system that takes people wherever they need to go, including work, school, and the airport. We will expand Chapel Hill's transit's fare-free service, the first in the nation, across town and county lines, where our neighbors will join us in helping our region become more affordable for all to enjoy. Development will provide our residents with opportunities to live near where they work and shop, making our town friendlier towards non-motorized travel. Our beautiful older buildings will be joined by modern construction that accentuates our character and charm. New development will encourage green design and preserve our tree canopy while providing a variety of housing and employment options that are convenient to our network of transit options. Our investments in affordability will enable those who make our town work, such as bus drivers, teachers, and nurses, to live here. Our downtown will grow to be vibrant, fun, and beautiful, featuring things to do for young and old alike. People will have green spaces and outdoor venues to mingle and meet their neighbors, friends, and visitors. Greenways and trails, as well as protected bike lanes, will allow people to get downtown and across town without getting in the car, while reasonable parking options will bring everyone downtown regardless of ability or mobility. Of course, all this depends on cooperation, partnership, and a community vision, not just mine. However, I truly believe that once our community sets a course, we can make great things happen. Next, Mark DeRozan, the managing attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law Regional Office, and he's in the Orange County Board of Commissioners. I approach the question of what Chapel Hill and Carrboro will look like in 2040 from my standard perspective. I believe in the goodness of people. And the alternative is simply too grim. With that context, in 2040, we live in a metro area, which includes Hillsboro, Mebane, Pittsboro, and Eastern Alamance, that has embraced its role as part of the Greater Triangle. Critical changes in the previous two decades have fostered opportunities to accommodate new growth at a rate more consistent with that of surrounding communities, but in a manner consistent with our social justice and environmental values. Frustrated by increasing wealth disparities among the highest in the state and incremental gains in affordable housing, and in line with our commitment to containing suburban sprawl, the community increased density within its towns by allowing multifamily development on all residential parcels. Targeted housing programs have made it easier for public employees to live in the towns in which they work. Higher density housing was also incentivized along transit corridors. After the closure of UNC's coal-fired power plant, the railroad right-of-way that served the university is now part of a greenway and bike path network that connects key transit hubs in Carrboro, Chapel Hill, and Hillsboro. High-speed internet access is available to every household in the county and the state, creating widespread opportunities for telecommuting and enhanced online education and training, thereby helping relieve traffic and transit problems and the related environmental impacts. Carrboro's downtown has continued to develop as an economic engine with new commercial and residential development along Roberson Street, including buildings back-to-back with the existing ones on Main. In Chapel Hill, the redeveloped multi-story University Place includes affordable and mixed-income housing, with units dedicated to residents displaced from the affordable but chronically flooded properties across the street, which have been restored to their natural state. Universal Pre-K has helped reduce the racial achievement gap and improve equity in our public schools, as has strategic commitment to recruiting and supporting a diverse educator workforce, all of which has been substantially bolstered by the state, finally living up to its constitutional obligation to fund a sound basic education for all students. Healthcare reform and living wage policies have reduced some effects of poverty in the community. In the courts, we've eliminated cash bail and restructured the use of fines and fees so that the system no longer criminalizes poverty. In recognition of the reality that the challenges we face are bound by jurisdictional lines, many local governments have strengthened their collaborations. Similarly, in recognition of the community's many strengths and resources, which some of our neighbors may lack, there are numerous inter-county collaborations with Person, Caswell, Alamance, and Chatham counties, similar to models already in place with Durham and Wake. Carborough, Chapel Hill 2040, now with more inclusion, equity, and diversity. And the Cat's Cradle is turning 70. All right, and we will move now to regional articles. And the first one will be back to our editor-in-chief, Jeffrey C. Billman. What will local media look like in 2040? Within a few months, the News and Observer, like all McClatchy publications, will end its Saturday print edition, pushing readers toward an e-edition instead. If you think that's the end of this trend rather than the beginning, if you think the NNO will be printing 6 newspapers a week a decade from now, I've got a bridge to sell you. I doubt they'll be printing 2 a week. The daily newspaper in Little Rock, Arkansas, is giving, as in for free, its 7-day-a-week subscribers iPads so they can access an e-edition of the paper, then teaching them how to use it. Many of them are old. Printing and circulating a physical newspaper is expensive. Emailing a digital version is cheaper. Hell, iPads are cheaper. The profitable Sunday edition, with its hefty supply of inserted ads, will still exist for now. The others will vanish. This is the near future of the erstwhile daily newspaper. 1 print product per week, supplemented by daily e-editions and websites to which you are directed by push notifications, tweets, and lots of newsletters, including morning and evening newsletters that serve the function that multiple editions of newspapers did decades ago. The disappearance of an anachronistic medium is nothing to shed tears over. The disappearance of local journalism, however, would be. Without it, residents would be uninformed. Local officials and special interests would be free to exploit their ignorance, and unexposed corruption would run rampant. So, to my mind, the pertinent question isn't what local journalism will look like in 2040, but the degree to which it will exist at all. I'll begin with our paper of record. I have little faith in the NNO Herald Sun under its current ownership. To be clear, that's not because I don't think highly of the paper's journalists and editorial managers. I do. Rather, it's because McClatchy has dug itself a hole from which I see no escape. As I write this, the entire company, almost 30 papers, has a market cap of just over $4 million. That's with an M. It has a mountain of debt, and while it's adding digital subscribers, it's hemorrhaging ad revenue. Bankruptcy seems inevitable. Sooner or later, sooner probably, the NNO will be sold, either individually or as part of a group. If the buyer is a hedge fund or a vulture company like Digital First Media, the NNO will die quickly, and we'll all suffer for it. A still but slightly less bad option is that it's gobbled up by a chain like Tribune or Gatehouse. Less likely but more optimistic, local interests by the NNO, aware that the margins will never be what they once were, but cognizant of the service the paper performs. Alternatively, like the Salt Lake Tribune or the Philadelphia Inquirer, the NNO is acquired by a non-profit and operated as a public trust. This is how local legacy media survives, not with companies that answer to shareholders, but with local owners whose first commitment is to their community. As Philip Napoli mentions later, the future of television news is equally uncertain. Viewers are aging and younger people aren't tuning in. And as Sarah Day Owen Wiskirchen discusses, an entire ecosystem of news organizations untethered to lengthy operations has developed to fill the void, many of them excellent. The nonprofits Carolina Public Press and NC Health News comes to mind. But I wonder if there's enough philanthropy to support all the local reporting that needs doing. I also wonder at what point reader-based revenue models will become untenable. That is, when will readers tired of being asked to support nearly every website they visit? Which reminds me, please go to keepitindie.com today to join the Indie Press Club and support fearless local journalism in the Triangle. I have little doubt that community journalism will become democratized over the next two decades. My concern is whether this will be a sustainable profession as Google and Facebook continue to hoover digital ad dollars. As for us, alt-weeklies, I probably think about our futures too much and about where the alts that fell over the last several years went wrong and how the rest of us can avoid their mistakes and misfortunes. In pessimistic moments, I wonder if we, too, are anachronisms of a bygone era that needed hellraisers and bomb throwers. If alts were the voice of the Internet before the Internet existed, what are we now that the Internet is everywhere? At the risk of sounding Pollyanna-ish, however, I see a path ahead, though it will require adaptation. The Indy of 2040, fingers crossed, will look nothing like the Indy of 2020, much less the Independent Weekly of 2000. Print, web, Twitter, TikTok, lasers beam directly into your brain, whatever. The medium never mattered. The journalism is what counts. And we can hear from Philip Napoli, a professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. Those of us who research local journalism feel a bit like climate scientists. But rather than warning of rising temperatures and melting ice caps, we chronicle newsroom closures, staff layoffs, and expanding news deserts across the country. And as with the climate, we are at a point with local journalism where the future looks very grim unless we make some dramatic changes. So, in predicting what local journalism in the Triangle is going to look like 20 years from now, I'm going to offer two forecasts. The first scenario assumes things continue as they are. The second assumes that we begin to make the kind of changes necessary to revive and stabilize local journalism. One, projecting from current trends, the next 20 years are likely to see the near eradication of local journalism as we have traditionally known it. The few local newspapers that remain in the Triangle will wither and die. The economic hardships that have affected local newspapers will take a similar toll on local television stations. Already, the typical local TV news viewer is quite old and getting older. As the current generation of local TV news viewers dies off, they are not going to be replaced because the next generation hasn't included local TV newscasts as part of their regular news diet. As a result, over the next 20 years, we should see the investment that local TV stations make in local news decline substantially. In terms of online news sources, the question is whether, at some point in the near future, they find a way to actually make money. When competing with digital giants like Facebook and Google for advertising dollars and or a way to get people to pay for digitally delivered news. They haven't found the answer over the past 15 years, so it seems unlikely they will find the answer sometime in the next 20. And when the economic motivation for providing news evaporates, that leaves the political motivation. We see the ramifications of this already as we're witnessing the rise of hyper-partisan local news outlets that really aren't news organizations at all. These are news sites financed and run by PACs, political parties and political candidates. However, these digital sites often masquerade as traditional news organizations, frequently concealing the details of their ownership and sources of financial support, and what they produce seldom meets the accuracy and objectivity standards of traditional journalism. As traditional local news outlets continue to fade away, these partisan propaganda outlets will increasingly fill the void. As a result, the next 20 years will likely see the kind of hyper-partisanship that characterizes national cable news become the norm in local journalism, leading to increasingly contentious, polarized, and unproductive local politics. Over the next 20 years, the last vestiges of the idea of objectivity in journalism may actually fall away. Scenario 2. The more optimistic scenario is one in which we move on from the idea of local journalism being sustainable commercial enterprise and embrace the idea of local journalism as a public service. In this scenario, the majority of local news organizations operate as nonprofits, supported by an as yet to be determined funding model. Maybe it's a tax on social media platform revenues, as some have proposed. Perhaps it's a massive expansion of philanthropic support at local, regional, and national levels for local journalism. Perhaps an enlargement of our existing public broadcasting system into a more expansive public media system, with the U.S. finally emerging from its position, bringing up the rear among developed nations in terms of how much we spend per capita on public service media. Most likely, it will take a combination of all of these and more for local journalism to regain its footing. Scenario 2 requires a massive change in how communities, news organizations, journalists, policymakers, and philanthropies think about local journalism. Fortunately, that change is starting to take place. This scenario could lead to higher quality journalism than what has been produced under the traditional commercial model. This scenario could lead to journalism freed to some extent from the pressure to maximize views, clicks, likes, and shares. As a result, it could lead to journalism that is less sensationalistic, more substantive, and that better serves the information needs of local communities. I return in the end to this climate change analogy. In terms of the climate and local journalism, we are at a critical juncture in terms of deciding what the next 20 years will bring. Zainab Belloc is a former candidate for Raleigh mayor, and he writes, "The future of social justice." We're all too familiar with the problems the Triangle's facing: rising housing prices, putting ownership out of reach, especially for millennials, sprawl, police brutality, long commutes, poverty, the climate crisis, etc. The path we choose now will determine whether we'll be a region comprising moral, equitable, and sustainable cities, or a failed urban landscape featuring inequity marked by unsustainable systems and processes. Now more than ever, we need leaders and an engaged electorate focused on developing a model of morally based good governance designed to yield equitable, sustainable outcomes in a high accountability environment. What will organizers and activists be tasked with addressing over the next 20 years? Let's use Raleigh as an example. Right now, the amount of money you have determines how much you matter. As Raleigh grows, only the wealthy are seeing the benefits. We see politicians run on promises of affordable housing and equality while also taking money from luxury developers who have made Raleigh the ninth fastest gentrifying city in the country. One out of every 7.1 residents lives in poverty. 132,000 people are food insecure, and in the face of our climate crisis, Raleigh's mediocre plan will take 31 years to become carbon neutral, while scientists have only given the planet 11 years to head off disaster. As our region grows, so will poverty and crime. The number of homeless children and youth in our school system has increased 27% in the past 2 years. We will face dwindling resources and inequalities in access to food and water. By 2040, the demand for water will exceed the supply in Raleigh. Social justice movements will have the difficult job of addressing present challenges while thinking innovatively about the future. We'll need to pursue a bold agenda, eradicating poverty and systemic racism, saving our environment, and changing the narrative about poverty from one that ignores the poor to one that recognizes their strength while questioning the morality of public policy. The next 20 years for community organizers will be exhausting and mentally taxing, but the most important in modern history. our region will need a moral revolution that places the needs of the poor and the planet at the heart of our policies and budget. Issues will be advocated for holistically, and communities will need to collaborate strategically. We'll need to utilize technology to scale out initiatives, build partnerships with public and private entities, and elect leaders who will value morality over money. But we'll also need the power of the people to attend every public meeting to push forward this moral agenda. By building power, shifting the narrative, and by organizing, we'll make sure that people have a right to thrive, not just barely survive. Every resident will be affected by these issues, but our empowerment lies in the fact that we are not alone, and that we are willing to come together to fight, to answer the tough questions about sustainability, resilience, economic vibrancy, and inclusiveness. The triangle will need everyone, rich people, doctors, lawyers, business people, but we will be working with the poor, not for the poor. We'll imagine a different region because things don't have to be this way. We will redesign, reimagine, and retool new visions of prosperity. This will create more jobs, build our infrastructure, strengthen our economy, and protect our resources for future generations. Generations that will be grateful for the generations before them who set them up to live equitably in the place they love calling home. This will redound to the benefit of all instead of the few. In the next 20 years, the Triangle has a rare opportunity to become an international model for how to shape a thriving and moral region. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The time is always right to do what is right." It's time, y'all. And James Michael Nichols, the Director of Communications for Equality NC, writes on the future of LGBTQ rights. Speculating about the future of a movement of any kind can be dangerous, but one thing I've learned writing about the LGBTQ movement over the years is that our community and the strides we've won are built on a shared sense of hope. Hope for a better future, and at least locally, a better North Carolina, where society's more vulnerable people, most vulnerable people, are cared for. For that reason, I'm approaching this vision of 2040 from a place of idealism, envisioning the world that I'd like to see for LGBTQ individuals living in North Carolina 20 years from now, and a world that I know many of us are fighting for every day. In many ways, the LGBTQ rights movement boils down to issues of access and safety. 20 years from now, I'd hope these concepts are realistically interwoven within the daily lives of LGBTQ folks living in the Triangle and all across this country. That, of course, would include comprehensive non-discrimination protections and full rights and protections under the law. HB2 and HB 142 would be distant memories, perhaps even laughable to consider that such legislation ever existed. Maybe kids would grow up without a socialized expectation of how their gender would shape their experiences in the world, and perhaps be given the space to self-determine their gender altogether. In the Triangle, 20 years would, ideally, bring a wider breadth of spaces for LGBTQ people, particularly a variety of spaces, not just bars and nightclubs. LGBTQ people deserve places to gather and cultivate community that aren't framed around alcohol. Sober spaces like LGBTQ coffee shops and other gathering points are crucial to catering to queer folks from all walks of life. It would also be beautiful to see our community reflected more comprehensively in the world around us. The election of 2 openly gay Raleigh City Council members bodes well for future LGBTQ representation in our local political leadership, and ideally that trend will continue. I hope that the domination of Raleigh's best downtown restaurants by openly gay restaurateurs continues, and that we continue to see openly LGBTQ business leaders push our cities into the future. Beyond that, my vision for 2040 is a vision for the future of our movement, beyond just the borders of North Carolina. Reparations for people of color. a breakdown of the prison industrial complex and functioning alternatives to incarceration, the eradication of homelessness and banning conversion therapy, universal health care, and a welcoming immigration policy, eliminating AIDS once and for all. It seems like a broad vision, but LGBTQ people are truly in every community, and as a result, a better world for LGBTQ folks looks like a better world for all communities who suffer under the current structures governing the world. In a world where the life expectancy of a trans woman of color is 35, my biggest hope for 2040 is in North Carolina and a planet where the LGBTQ community no longer faces daily threats of fear and violence. For some members of our community, the culture of America has shifted in such a way we no longer have to fear regular harassment, discrimination, or violence. But for many people who call themselves LGBTQ, things haven't gotten much better. What will life look like for LGBTQ people in 2040? An unbridled sense of freedom for anyone who calls themselves LGBTQ. Well, the time has run out for this edition of Indie Week. I hope I've selected enough balance in these articles because I had to skip about 10 or 12 of them. North Carolina's Reading Service, formerly Triangle Radio Reading Service, recorded this for a blind and print-impaired audience. After our initial broadcast, you can replay it as a blog from our webpage. And I'm John Fetterson, and thank you very much for listening to Indie Week.